I'm such a dork.
Yes, you are. You are. Well, folks, welcome to the dorkiness and a slut's guide to happiness, where your body is perfectly imperfect and it's safe to be as sexual, kinky, queer, or slutty as you want. Today, I will be talking with T-Max, a queer community leader and wonderful friend who is a lighthearted ball of giggling energy and free wood sprite. I want to show you their eyebrows. I walked in today and saw them, and they are a perfect example of their wood sprite little energy. So if you want to show, they have glitter. I thought that it was a mistake and they accidentally ran into a child that like was touching their face, but it's just their beautiful, fabulous makeup.
Hopefully it is.
Yes. But so this energy of just fabulousness that T-Max wears in the world now, that is from their eyebrows to their spirit and their Jewish grandma energy out there, that hasn't always been the case, as with a lot of people who are on the winding journey of finding themselves. So today we're going to be talking about a specific tough but common experience of growing up as a closeted queer teenager in a religious family and conservative part of rural America, because, man, that exists for a lot of people in their lives. And that childhood has had ripple effects on T-Max's life, and like a lot of people in environments socializing us to straightness and compulsory monogamy, that required a journey to learn through and from. We're also going to be talking about how they survived, how they finally navigated to where they are today in their wood sprite fabulousness, as well as recommendations for folks who are similarly exploring their queerness for the first time in a second chapter of their life. So T-Max, thank you for joining us.
You're certainly welcome.
I'd like to go to the transition point moment in your life.
Okay.
So you're telling me about a realization you had when you were in counseling 5 years ago. What was it that you discovered?
I had a traumatic brain injury, skateboarding, and, afterwards, I just, like, you know, I made several changes in my life where, on paper, like, things should have been fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And they just weren't still. Mm-hmm. It was more than 5 years ago. In June of 2017, I decided that I needed to go to therapy. Mm-hmm. And started to put in the work, to get in touch with myself, in touch with, like, how my brain was functioning or not functioning. Mm-hmm. And that little journey kicked off a real revelation, and one of those sort of first sort of things that I had to come to grips with was, like, as a 14-ish, 15-year-old, I discovered punk rock, I discovered skateboarding, and that I was queer, all within about 3-ish months of each other. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a part of Minnesota that was not welcoming to that. We were just far enough away from Minneapolis that it was a little bit backwards. Mm-hmm. And so I learned pretty quickly that, like, you know, it, one of those, you know, all three things were kind of trouble, but one of those three things was, like, you know, like, really could be life-threatening. Mm-hmm. And for that, and for a variety of reasons, like, it was just, like, the queer part of me went right back into the closet, never to see the light of day, really, until, you know, yeah, that day, basically, or wow, that early chapter in my therapy process where I was had to reckon with it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you are, let's see, 5 years ago, so you would have been, how old were you at the time?
Like late 40s.
Okay, so in your late 40s, you're thinking back on a moment of loss of the possibility of your identity as a queer teenager when you were 14 or 15. Mm-hmm. And you were having that realization for the first time, so you didn't realize you had to stomach that when you were 14?
Yeah, it was, yeah. It was, I mean, it, well, it was just, it was a non-decision at 14.
Mm. It just was not something you could consider.
Like, it was my high school experience, I mean, this is a little dark, but, like, my high school experience, even without the layer of being queer on it, was very violent.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you know, you, I guess we could edit it out, but, like, whatever, F slur warning, but, like, you know, in my high school, in the cornfields of Minnesota, right, it was better to be a skater fag or a punk fag than to actually be a fag,
mm-hmm.
because the beatings were a little different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I kind of say that with a smile, just because it's like, that's how uncomfortable it is to
mm-hmm.
me still.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, like, that's the decision I made at that moment. And I was just like, yep, psh, oop, done.
Yep. So when you say it is life-threatening, you don't say that in a simple way.
No.
The violence was real.
Yeah.
I want to come back to that in a minute, because that is really deep and powerful. And I want to first go back a little bit earlier in your life,
mm-hmm.
because I know that by the time you got to age 14, a lot of this need to suppress yourself was also ingrained from other processes in your life, right? So I think that's true for a lot of people, especially when it's like the whole environment is
mm-hmm.
telling you that you have to hide your whole self
early
in your life.
Very early.
So what was it like growing up in a religious household? What lessons were taught about how you had to be, and how were those lessons communicated or enforced to you?
So I grew up in a very, very, like a deeply rigorous Catholic household.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where, like, you know, my parents were, still are, put out that they don't do the mass in Latin anymore.
Okay.
Like, that kind of rigor, right?
Uh-huh,
like,
uh-huh.
It's a little bit of hyperbole, but it really is, like, they are, like, that entrenched. And it was just, you know, like, from a very early age, I just kind of understood that, like, you know, like, oh, and the other really key ingredient is that I was adopted,
mm.
right? And that wasn't like it was hidden from me or anything like that. My parents were actually very, very cool in that respect. Like, they let me know that I was adopted, and we're gonna be adopted. They adopted my sister not long after I came around. But, like, you know, so like, there were two things, right? There was this heavy rigor, and then and then the knowledge that I was, you know, actually not their kid. So, like, even though I think it was best that they were open about it, like, it all, I also came away with, like, this sort of feeling that I was just kind of an outsider
mm.
a little bit.
Mm.
And so it was just, yeah, so there, it set up this, you know, this dynamic where, you know, in order to meet, brought me in,
mm-hmm.
so I better, you know, I want to stay here.
Mm-hmm.
I need them for safety and shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this also this expectation of the religion that they follow.
Mm-hmm.
And so it turned into a very performative
mm-hmm.
sort of exercise,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which was, you know, that's a lot
mm-hmm.
for a little kid to sort of take on.
Mm-hmm.
In
order to be safe, to have the housing and stability and probably emotional support that they were offering you, the expectation, I don't know if it was stated or implied, was that you conform to the
mm-hmm.
religious practices of their family.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or just, I don't know, like, they're even also just that, like, you know, I think I had it in my head that because I came from the outside, like, they can return me. Like, even though, like, I never, like, it was never threatened or implied or anything like that, but,
mm-hmm.
it, like, it, maybe I was told I was adopted a little too young, maybe, you know, like, when they take puppies away from its mom too early, I don't know. But, yeah, so that was kind of the setup.
Mm-hmm.
And it was super challenging, and I was also very... I think I'm free now. I was a very free child,
hmm.
you know, and
hmm.
it was a child of the 70s, and I just didn't like wearing clothes.
So things haven't changed too much.
Definitely gone full circle on that side of things. And
I want to pause and just clarify.
Yes.
You didn't like wearing clothes, and then you were socially enforced to wear clothes, and you had to come back to realizing that it was okay to not wear clothes sometimes. Right, yes. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that's where I was going with it. Was just like there was, you know, like it was cute, mm-hmm. and then it wasn't cute in the flip of a switch, mm-hmm. And I didn't understand why, mm-hmm. right? Like and so because I was still a little kid, mm-hmm. but like there was somewhere in that like I don't know 4 or 5-ish mm-hmm. age range where like it was like. Like, it just, all of a sudden, no, you're not allowed to be naked anymore, and it's bad, mm-hmm. and you have to cover that up, and it's like, wait, that was cool 2 days ago, like, but it's hot out, you know, like, it's muggy in the middle, anyway, and I always liked my body, as a, you know, as I think back to it, you know, like, I've had a lot of time to do a lot of work, and so, you know, like, and once again, I learned to take a piece of me and put it into a little container and put it, at that age, I didn't put it completely away, but I just put it over here to the side. And, you know, like there would, you know, there's a specific set and setting for that, but it, you know, I can't just strip down and run through the backyard where, cause in the Midwest, nobody has fences. So anyway. Yeah, not much privacy.
So you learned at 4 to begin the process of compartmentalizing pieces of yourself, to hide pieces of yourself until you're in an environment where it's safe.
Yes.
But that environment was often not your home environment, not with your family.
Yeah. And so, and you know, shortly after we moved, because we lived in closer in the suburbs of Minneapolis, but then when I was in, like, early elementary school. So anyway, we moved about 45 miles north. And so once we were in the country, basically, it was where the suburbs ended. And so we lived in a little subdivision, but like my backyard was like, I think it was cornfields from there to Fargo. Like it was just,
rural.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was it. Right. And so I could, you know, and it was, you know, it was the late 70s, early 80s. So kids were just allowed to walk out the back door and then come home at dinner. Right? And so I had a lot of time to myself, and I just would go off into the cornfield and find a little open patch or whatever and, like, you know, strip down and lay in the sun and, like, just, like, you know, I could just breathe. And, you know, and also, like, if you're not in the house, you can't get in trouble. Right? Like, you know, there's... It was just kind of like, you know, like a little mini pirate life off in the farmlands, really. I got in trouble a couple of times because, you know, some of the neighbor kids came with or something, and then, you know, the shame got to them, and they and they squealed. Well, I don't know if you should say squealed, but, you know, they caved and or it came out in some sort of other way. And then once again, like we were talking about before, like that Catholic rigor, like the main implement was shame.
Mm-hmm. How dare you do this? Who are you?
Yeah. Like? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it, I mean, it was unfortunate. It also came with a bit of like with a physical, punishment in terms of spankings and things like that. But like, corporal punishment, but like the really the toughest one of that bunch was the shame that came with it. And you were just meant to you were shown that was wrong, and that you should feel bad about your body. And how you enjoy your body.
Right.
Yeah. So
because shame then becomes an internalized narrative about yourself, and you begin to control yourself instead of that space that was that pocket of freedom that you created for yourself in the cornfields.
Mm-hmm.
Once you internalize that shame, even if the cornfields are still there, it's not, you can't access that freedom in the same way.
Right.
How did you deal with it then? Because you're increasingly getting these shame narratives about yourself. How is that impacting you as you're evolving and developing as a child?
Well, first of all, don't tell me I can't do something.
Oh, you got a stubborn streak.
No, I have a real problem with authority. It just taught me to keep a closer circle. Mm. Like, it basically just taught me how to be, a more crafty weirdo. I've seen it said a couple of times, like, when you talk about me as a kid, don't say I was an old soul. I was a weird kid. I was a really weird kid. Anyway, so, whatever the little group of neighborhood kids, it just condensed down to, me and a couple people, right? And people I could really, it helped me build, early trust circles. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of that, I did still feel shame, mm-hmm. right? Because I knew I was going back to a place where, I was having a really good time, and then I gotta go home, and then, I can't be too smiley, because then mm-hmm. if they ask me what I did all day, I don't want to lie. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That doesn't get you anywhere, it was almost like how they say, you go to prison and you learn how to be a better criminal. Mm-hmm. There's the shame loop is, yeah. Doesn't do anybody any good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're finding this little group of friends mm-hmm. that help you to still have play and enjoy mm-hmm. and try to be yourself and explore this world, and then going back to the contrast of your family at mm-hmm. home. So it sounds like that's one of the survival strategies that you've had then, and I see in your life that you have now. You find your little group of people. Mm-hmm. What were some of the messages that you were receiving? So you mentioned nudity as one. What mm-hmm. were some of the other messages that you were receiving from your childhood family about what was and wasn't okay with your body or your gender or your way of being in the world?
Those were elementary school years, but then once I started to branch out and, into middle school and high school mm-hmm. and after discovering punk rock and going to the used clothing store and buying old, army things and shredding them up and stuff like that, that's when it really kind of got pretty ugly, mm. right? Because I definitely wasn't fitting the social construct, right? Mm-hmm. And even though I didn't have the words for it at the time, I dressed fairly androgynously. Mm-hmm. I had longish hair. Mm-hmm. It just didn't go well at all. And I had a girlfriend with a mohawk for a while, and so it got real spicy real quick. and that's when we really started to butt heads. And that's another, one of the ingredients why, when those three kind of things showed up for me, mm-hmm. the queer side of me had to go very far away.
Yeah, yeah. So returning to that, the life-threatening environment that you were talking about before... Yes. I imagine that it is a common experience for many teenagers, in rural America. Mm-hmm. It was in the 1970s, 80s? 80s?
It was the 80s,
okay.
Yeah, by the time it was 80s.
Yeah. By the time you're 14, that's right. Mm-hmm. And I think that things have gotten better, but I know that there are still spaces in the country where it was unsafe. I was growing up in a city at the time, and so I do remember being called a faggot. I was kissing my girlfriend and across from the car, another mm-hmm. car shouted that. And that was a really core kind of shame experience, but I'd never had the experience of feeling like my life was threatened in that moment or any other homophobic encounters. Mm-hmm. And so I think it is something specific and different that there's a big diversity in this country of cultures and spaces of safety. So I want to hear if you can tell more about what that experience was like. When you say that it felt unsafe to come out as queer, who are the kind of people that you were afraid of interacting with, and what messages were you receiving from others about queerness or why it was bad?
Oh man. Um, It was, you know, like, well, first of all, the F slur was pervasive in the mid-80s. And so everything that didn't fit, like, the football jocko norm had an F slur attached to it. And so in one particular experience, I went to, even though it was rural, I went to a very large high school, like, cause it kind of like was, I don't know, people came from far away for it. Right. And so there were, I don't know, 1200 people in our high school or something, like it was over 1,000 people in the high school. And so, you know, people would be milling around in the morning and just wearing my skateboard I was in the marching band and I had just gotten back from California because I was in the Tournament of Roses parade as a marching band member, and I had purchased some skateboard pants called Jimmy Z's. They were so cool. They were like linen and they had a Velcro belt and they had a lot of room in them to skate. Uh-huh. And I was so happy. Uh-huh. They were so cool, and you couldn't get those in Minnesota. Like, uh-huh. You really couldn't. And almost immediately, because you could see it said Jimmy Z on the little, there was a little tag on the thing, uh-huh. And there were a group of dudes that started to follow me around in the morning, and because I was wearing those pants, and so my name from then on was Jimmy Z Fag.
Wow.
And they would just follow me around.
In response just to the pants?
Just the pants.
Do you think that wearing those pants made you read to them as queer? Or just as, like,
just an outsider? Just different. Yeah. And
the worst thing to be different at that time was fag. Like, yeah, that was the word used to generally describe
but,
difference.
Like, even, you know, but it wasn't, you know, there's also the F slurs used in locker room talk. So it wasn't, it was, you know, it was truly intended, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. The use of that word. And then of course it morphed into skater F slur. And I still have a hard time saying it to this day, right? Mm-hmm. Because it was a part of my everyday landscape for like months. And then eventually I turned around one day and I was like, look, I know that you guys follow me around every day. I know you have a pet name for me, but actually that's not my name. My name's Tom.
Aww.
And I went to shake hands with them and they all backed up except for one.
That is an incredible lesson in coping strategy.
It didn't turn out very good.
Yeah.
But I was just like, but you know,
what was the result?
A huge fight.
Physical fight.
Yes.
Between you and these people,
you know, when I turned around to shake hands and introduce myself, mm-hmm, whatever, there's probably five or six of them, right? Mm-hmm. All of them went back except for the big one, mm-hmm, who was not the sharpest one.
Yeah.
And so I introduced myself to him. I'm like, my name's not Jimmy Z Fag. It's Tom.
Uh-huh.
So nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Don't touch me, fag.
That's what they said.
Don't fucking touch me, fag. And then a fight ensued, and I kicked the shit out of him. And then he threatened to stab me in the principal's office afterwards, in front of the principal.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I hear what you're saying about him not being particularly smart.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm really sorry that happened to you.
It was heavy.
Yeah.
That's an example, and that happened often.
And I just want to name how incredibly beautiful and brave it was that you turned around to those people who were following you and you stated clearly what your boundary was and you offered your hand.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. Even though it was received in a terrible way and threatened your life afterwards.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was weird. I mean, also I'm also very snarky. So, but I did offer my hand, right? Like it was genuine and, it was, so that's kind of an example of what I mean by a violent, you know, middle school, high school, and what I mean by, you know, like truly not feeling safe, like in my community, in my education community, because it was like, those kids were,
Did your parents know about this happening?
Yeah, but they just were like, oh, you know, boys will fight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of an accepted thing that boys will be boys. They'll right. just do this.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't throw the first punch. So, like, you know, there wasn't any extra punishment on the home side of things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I don't know if I told them it was because they called me fag or not, but anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I want to say I am so glad that you survived. Like, in some ways, there's some like, we can laugh about it now because you're here and you made it, but right. also that what you're describing is really heavy.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you could have died. And I know that there are a lot of queer and trans people, even today, who do die mm-hmm. as a result of bullying,
yeah.
so... You made it.
I made it.
Yeah.
I made it. It's yeah. It was it was not a pleasant high school experience to say the least. But yeah, I made it, and mm-hmm. Just wanna share my story so that other people can hopefully have a different experience.
Yeah, and I hear that one of the ways that you coped with it, because there are all kinds of, we can't judge each other at all for the ways that we survive impossible situations.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ways you survived that impossible situation was by going into the closet, right? You chose
yes.
queerness not an option for me right now.
Yeah.
So you had quite a while of, you had learned kind of from your religious family that monogamy was the expectation, getting
yes.
marriage was the expectation, being straight was the expectation.
Mm-hmm.
So for a while, you lean into the expectations, and then things started going differently as you realized maybe this isn't what I want.
Right. Yeah, so going back to that, dynamic early in my therapy experience,
mm-hmm.
I came to grips with that realization about, like, discovering those three things as that teenager,
yeah.
and putting one of them super, super far away.
Mm-hmm.
It was absolutely a survival technique, and I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like, oh yay, because I had a life, and but I also, I had a life structured in a certain way,
mm-hmm.
and this ran contrary to it because of how deeply I had put that into the proverbial closet,
mm-hmm.
and but at some point it just it hurt too much not to be me,
mm.
Because I can't unlearn that, right,
mm-hmm.
or unrealize it, right,
mm-hmm.
I just really wanted to, I wanted to be myself,
yeah.
finally.
And that was in your late 40s you're talking about.
47-ish,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So, from 14, when you stuffed away your queerness, until 47,
mm-hmm.
you did your best you could to fit within the box of what was safe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then something bubbled over at 47, and you realized, oh, actually, I want to be myself. So then what happens? When you're 47, you're realizing you're redefining your life for the world.
Yeah. A lot of it was still internalized, and I had to keep it hidden for a variety of reasons. And, in March of last year, I separated from my ex, and I've been, I've been able to really lean in,
mm-hmm.
since then, and start to explore, and like when I say baby queer, I really do mean, like, I
yeah.
just, you know, like,
you left your ex-wife of how many years?
Of over 20 years.
Wow, yeah. So for 2 decades, you were living
mm-hmm.
a marriage, a life that
mm-hmm.
looked like how normative society says we're supposed to be doing it.
Yes.
And then you embarked on this whole other journey.
Right.
So what was it like coming out as a, I love that word that you use, the baby queer. What was it like coming out
yeah.
as a baby queer?
Baby queer at
yeah.
50. And,
mm-hmm.
It's been overwhelmingly positive.
Hmm.
Like, it really has. It's really, like, one of the most interesting things for me is, like, just, like, and of course, this comes with there was a lot of therapy. There was years and years of therapy that went into this before this decision,
mm.
and a lot of work,
mm-hmm.
and all, but when I get up in the morning, I've always had a really, really bad, or really poor body image,
mm-hmm.
And now when I wake up in the morning and brush my teeth, like, I actually like the person that I see in the mirror, which is, like, bizarre. Like, I always had there was always issues with my body, how I looked, you know, like, trying diets, trying running, trying this, trying that, and, like, you know, there were stretches where I looked a little different, but, like, I'm just kind of a chonky dude, you know, at its root, and, that likes pretty things, and, you know, like, now that gets to be my everyday.
Something about unlearning the internalized shame that you are not allowed to be queer also seeped over to the internalized shame about your body. So that you can now look at yourself in the mirror and feel good about what you're seeing. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That transformation about how you feel about yourself and your body.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, because of those early, you know, experiences running around naked in the cornfield and having to feel so much shame. And the fact that I've always been fairly athletic in a different, you know, through skateboarding and snow sports and stuff like that. But I've always kind of had moobs.
Wait, what was that word you just said?
Moobs.
Are those man boobs?
Man boobs. Like, even as a little kid, and I was, like, really self-conscious about it. And then, you know, like, after, you know, leaning into this sort of more gender fluid, non-binary space, like, well, guess what?
It's kind of lovely. I already started to have these things that I want.
Yeah. And so, like, it's just, like, there's just, like, all of these little, so since coming out and since being, you know, and being on my own and being able to, like, really truly explore these places, like, it's just this domino thing.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely wonderful.
I really love that what you're describing, the fact of your body, your chest didn't change. What changed was how you looked at it.
Right.
Because you were given the space to explore what are the different things that this could mean? What does this mean for me? What do I think about this? Rather than, like, what am I told that I should think about this and how I should feel about this?
Right.
Forcing my body and my mind and my desires to fit inside the box.
Right.
But in order to get to that place, you had to lose the shame that you were taught.
Yep.
And you had to give yourself permission to write your own story about your body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah. And I mean, I am very, very fortunate. Like, I have access to health. First of all, I have healthcare.
Uh-huh.
Right? And I have access to mental health care.
Mm-hmm.
And I have access to mental health care that allows me to buy, you know, the proper medication for my mental health care. And so, you know, like, there are, you know, there are certainly some layers of privilege woven into all of this progress, but but at the same time, you're right. Like, it was, you know, it wasn't something that just happened overnight. It happened, you know, over the course of, you know, 5 or 6 years.
Have you ever felt, so I know that in counseling, a lot of times it's going back to the childhood experiences like diving through what that looks like. So either in counseling or in general in your experience in your life, have you ever felt that little kid in you come back up and hearing, you know, like the pain and the vulnerability and the desire to be accepted or desire to be yourself and having to reparent yourself to feel that it's safe, especially given that you were talking about that you literally were unsafe, your life was threatened. That, like, how do you teach the little kid in you, oh, no, wait, this is a different world, it's safe.
Right, and there is, like, this interesting thing that happens. It's almost like a re-adolescence-ing. And so there are moments where I just kind of, like, go, okay, you know, like, you can, you know, you get to do this now. You live in a, you know, you live in a major metropolitan West Coast city that's fairly liberal, and, you know, like, you can try on that dress.
Mm-hmm.
You can try on that, you know, that cute bra that you saw. Like, it, you know, and you can wear it to the coffee shop in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's okay. You will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's your internal narrative. That's you telling yourself, reminding yourself it's okay.
Yeah, yeah. You'll be okay, and, you know, like, you can wear this today, and if it doesn't work, if it's not for you, it can be, you know, you don't, it doesn't have to, it's this, it, none of this is forever,
yeah,
you know, yeah. And, which is true of so many things, and so it's just, you know, like, that's sort of the mindset right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. giving yourself permission, reminding yourself it will be okay.
Yeah, yeah. Give yourself permission to remind yourself that you like you can try this on, and it really will. It'll be okay.
Mm-hmm. It's okay to make mistakes in the process. Choose things that you don't want.
Oh my god! And it can get messy, and it can get weird, and like you know, like it's all of those things are all part of the process.
Yeah. So if you could write a love note back to yourself as a young adult, or to young adults that today are living in really conservative households, or in, you know, conservative parts of rural America, to soften, or to support, or to allow for the freedom of people who are living in spaces where it's very difficult to be free and authentic, what are some of the things you'd put into your love note?
You are, it's right back to where I was, you know, 2 minutes ago. You are okay. There's nothing wrong with you. Mm. Like, this is, you know, like, it is very, very difficult. And, you know, like, just be patient. And you are okay. And you are loved. And there is, your tribe is out there. Like, it really is. Like, your tribe is out there. And, you know, it will happen with time and patience. And, it doesn't have to be solved overnight, but, you know, like, trust it.
I love that. I feel that so hard that every time I find the courage to be a little bit more open about some scary part of myself, I realize, oh, actually, there's a bunch of people over there saying, hey, me too!
Yeah.
And you just find those little people, those little corners of the world that you didn't realize existed, except they do, and we are here for you. We're the queeros in the world, and there's so many of us. Yes. There's so many. Say hi, come dance in the joy, come dance in the cornfield naked with us. Thank you, D-Max.
Of course. Oh, yes.
This has been another edition of A Slut's Guide to Happiness with your host, Vanessa Cliff. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple and Spotify, as well as on VanessaCliff.com. Please help us get the message of slut positive joy and freedom and healing. Like and share this podcast and stay tuned for more deep dives into beautiful, messy waters of the experience of being human. If you're over the age of 18, you can also check out our video content on our website, VanessaCliff.com. And most of all, I invite you to join us in the pleasure of being awkwardly human, naked, and without pretense. Let's get free.